The title of today's message is Absalom, number two. It's part two in a series, and we'll conclude the study on Absalom today. And I'd like to just mention why it is that we study these stories in the Bible like we do. Why do we study the Bible? There's something that I've noticed in the Church of God over the years, and it's a misnomer that we need to be careful about. You know, knowing the Bible doesn't make us good. Knowing the Bible does not make us righteous. It's not an end in itself to study the Bible or read the stories or even to be able to memorize scriptures and to give them back. It's not knowing the Bible or studying the Bible that makes us good. There are many people that know the Bible. Some of them know the Bible a whole lot better than people in the church do. Many study the Bible who aren't converted at all. Never assume then, brethren, well, I studied the Bible, therefore I'm good. It doesn't work that way. You know, the Bible records the truth in all honesty. It's not like other books. First of all, it's inspired by God. It's God-breathed. They're the words of God. But the Bible records the good, the bad, and the ugly, even about God's servants, even about God's leaders, even about God's prophets. I'd like you to turn over to 2 Samuel chapter 13 as we begin today. Brethren, the Bible is brutally honest in revealing the sins, the weaknesses, and the faults of the great men, even, of the Bible. And you and I can certainly learn from their mistakes. We can learn from their victories, from their overcoming, from the way God worked in their lives. We study into the Word of God so that we might be able to live godly lives. That's the main purpose that we study into the Bible, to know God and to communicate with God. God communicates to us, with us, through the words of His Bible. We communicate in turn with God through our prayers. And so we study the Bible so that we can get a better grasp of the principles of Jesus Christ and apply them in all of our daily living. Not just at church on the Sabbath, but all throughout the week. Day and night, at work, at play, no matter where we are. Let's begin this study on Solomon, part two, with a brief review from part one. And we had seen where Tamar, after she had been violated by her brother, by her half-brother, she remained desolate in her brother Absalom's house. Let's pick up the story in 2 Samuel 13 and verse 21. But when King David heard of these things, he was very wroth. That means he was very angry. And naturally so. If a father finds out that one of his children has brutally raped against their will, which is what rape is, one of the other children, it is very disturbing. It is very upsetting. It reveals that there are some very deep-seated problems within the family. But it's an interesting insight into the character of David. Even though David was very angry, he did nothing. And time went on. It went on for a year. It went on for 2 years. 2 Samuel 13, drop down to verse 23. It came to pass after two full years that Absalom had sheep shears in Baal Hazor, which is beside Ephraim, and Absalom invited all the king's sons. He wanted everybody there. Now, it might be that David had an inkling that something was amiss. He even invited David. Absalom said, you know, to his dad, David, please come to the sheep shearing. It's a big shindig. It's a big get together. There's a lot of going on. A lot of news changes hands. It's like family reunion and all that. But David declined. But David did let Amnon go. And we see what happens to Amnon, the one who raped his sister Tamar. Verse 28, 2 Samuel 13, 28. Now Absalom had commanded his servants, saying, mark you now when Amnon's heart is merry with wine, and when I say unto you, smite Amnon, then kill him. Fear not. Have not I commanded you? Be courageous and be valiant. So here we have a situation where Absalom has quite a bit of authority and control over his servants, so much so that they believe that they can commit murder and be indemnified, be held innocent. I was only following orders, like we've seen so many people throughout history fall into this same kind of situation. But Absalom kills his brother, his half-brother, Amnon. Verse 29, "And the servants of Absalom did unto Amnon as Absalom had commanded. Then all the king's sons arose, and every man got him up on his mule and fled." You can imagine how they scattered when all of a sudden a murder is committed. These men must have been somewhat looking over their shoulder all the time anyway, because of the intrigue that's in royal circles, wondering, you know, who's going to get the throne, who's going to bump who off, and that sort of thing. And they must have scattered instantly, you know, when this murder took place. Verse 31, drop down a little bit. "And then the king arose and tore his garments." When King David knew what had happened, he thought that all of his sons, every heir to the throne, had been killed. He didn't know what had happened. He laid down on the earth. It seems like a lot of times in the scriptures when there's great tragedy like this, men lay face down on the earth. "And his servants stood by him with their clothes rent." They were mourning and in turmoil as well. Verse 32. "And Jonadab, the son of Shimeah, David's brother, answered and said." Let me point out here, brethren, today we'll see just a couple of little instances like this. Here's one of David's brothers, and he's in the close household. We'll see later on if it works into the sermon that one of David's sisters is close by. There's a lot of family involved, and we can assume that there's a great deal of interplay with the family that's not at all recorded in the Bible. But anyway, this is a nephew of David, Jonadab. He answered and said, "Let not my Lord suppose that they have slain all the young men, the king's sons, for Amnon only is dead. For by the appointment of Absalom, this has been determined from the day that he forced his sister Tamar." So somehow Jonadab knew what had actually happened, that only Amnon had been killed, and that Absalom had been premeditating this murder since the day that Tamar was raped. Now, the scriptures tell us that Absalom was angry and vengeful because of the rape of Tamar, but also in the back of his mind, it is clear that Absalom realizes that that puts him just one step closer to the throne of David, something that ate on Absalom all the time. Why am I number three in the line of succession? After all, I'm the best looking, the smartest, the most reliable, the most qualified to sit on the throne. He's probably thinking those kind of things day in and day out as he looked down his nose at other people. But brethren, there's something else I'd just like to point out here when he says, "For Amnon only is dead." That is a terrible understatement to say only one of your children is dead. Don't ever tell someone who's lost a child, "Well, at least you have your other children. Don't let it get you down. You have the others." Don't say that to people. It doesn't work that way. A life is a precious life, and to lose one child is to a parent as though they have lost everything, and there is not comfort in the fact that you have other children, not at that time when you've lost a child. Verse 33, he continues, "Now therefore, let not my lord the king take this thing to his heart." You know, don't let it get you down to think that all the king's sons are dead, for Amnon only is dead. You know, it's not so bad. Well, it was. It was terrible for King David. And we touched on these scriptures last time, but let's briefly go over them again. Verse 37, "Absalom fled and went to Talmai, the son of Amihud, king of Geshur. And David mourned for his son every day." You don't get over something like this. You grieve. And brethren, when somebody is grieving, you have to let them go through the grieving process. You can't say, snap out of it, get over it, let it go. God understands that we have to grieve, and grieving is a process. And the more you love someone, the more you grieve. And the more you depended on them, the more your life was interrelated, the longer the grief goes on. Be concerned and be loving and encourage those who are going through the grieving process. It's like half of you, or more than half of you, has died when you lose a loved one. Verse 38. So Absalom fled, and he went to Geshur, and he was there for 3 years. So now it's been 5 years since the rape of Tamar. A lot of time has gone on. Absalom has had a lot of time, at least 5 years, to contemplate, you know, what he might do to ascend to the throne. Verse 39. And the soul of David longed to go forth unto Absalom, for he was comforted concerning Amnon, seeing he was dead. He finally came through his grief. His grief was fulfilled. And he began to think, David began to think, what about my son Absalom? What's he going through? You know, I love him. I want for him to do well. This is a terrible thing that's happened. David never did deal with any kind of punitive or punishment measures with Absalom for having killed Amnon, but now it's in the past. Absalom has, in a way, righteously slain Amnon for his sin. But David didn't know how to deal with it. It was unjust of David not to handle the matter, to indulge Absalom. It was during this time period, during these 5 years, that Absalom's alienation from his father really began to take root and to grow. David didn't know how to deal with Absalom, but he refused Absalom permission to return. Absalom had distanced himself, you know, when he killed Amnon, and David wasn't about to let him come back. So how's reconciliation going to take place? The fact that Absalom was separated from David tended to make the problem worse. And we know in hindsight that in Absalom's mind, reconciliation wasn't what he was concerned about for the sake of love and peace and fatherly love. The only reconciliation that Absalom might have been concerned about was how to get his foot back in the door, to get his name back in the running so that he might be king. There was terrible intrigue brewing under the surface, and partially because David didn't deal with the problem. It wasn't handled. Absalom, just by nature, was ambitious. He was unprincipled. And there, I think we have to stop and think. Did King David teach his children godly ways? David knew a great deal about godly ways at this time. I wish there was a way we could go back and chronologically figure out when it was that David actually became converted, when he was given God's Holy Spirit, when he had a relationship with God the Father, when it was that he had repented of his sins to the extent and in the way that conversion was completed. He became a child of God, eligible for the first resurrection and so forth. We know that King David is going to be in the first resurrection, which means he is converted. He has God's Holy Spirit. He prayed after the sin with Bathsheba, which is much later than this. You know, take not your Holy Spirit from me, I pray, when he realized, you know, what a terrible sinner he was and when the prophet pointed it out to David. But at this particular time, these 5 years, Absalom is shut out. He's exiled from participation in the affairs of the kingdom. And during that period of time, he gave himself over to a very dangerous scheming. How will I take over the throne? What needs to be removed so that I can be set up? Who do I need to be allied with? Who will my supporters be? And so forth. After a period of time, Joab determined to effect a reconciliation between the father and the son. You remember Joab, he's the commander-in-chief of David's army. David, a man after God's own heart, was also feeling his own need, you know, to show godly mercy to his son Absalom. And when he was approached by Joab, you know, let Absalom come back, he couldn't resist the appeal from Joab. He was willing to say, okay, let him come on back. And so David told Joab, go therefore and bring the young man Absalom again. Bring him back into my presence. And so Absalom was permitted to return to Jerusalem but he was not able to go into David's home, to the royal court, to meet with his father. Next chapter, 2 Samuel 14, verse 1. Now Joab, the son of Zeruiah, perceived that the king's heart was towards Absalom. It means that David really wanted to have a relationship with Absalom. He cared about him. He wanted the best for him. Now, I'll skip over this next part, but Joab enters into this conspiracy with this woman from Tekoa, and they devise a plan to get David to bring Absalom back. They feel like they have to trick David into making the decree. So she comes up with a story that's very, very similar to the one, the situation that has taken place between David and Absalom. And she tells the king the story, knowing that the king, with a good heart, will say, yeah, that's right, bring him back. But David was pretty smart. He was a brilliant man. We can see that from the Psalms and his leadership and the way that God worked with him. And he figured out what was going on. Drop down to verse 21, 2 Samuel 14, 21. And the king said to Joab, behold now, I have done this thing. Go therefore and bring the young man Absalom again. But David was still unable to deal with Absalom. He grants them that Absalom can come on back, but what's David going to do? Is he going to try Absalom for the murder of David's firstborn Amnon? Do you just forget about that when one of the sons is killed, in cold-blooded murder? The fact that he was David's son, he was in line for the throne, it was all too complicated for David. I'm saying that. I'm not sure what the motivations were for David. Was David saying, I'll teach Absalom a lesson, I'll wait longer? Maybe he was doing like we have the example of the prodigal son in the New Testament. It's proper for the son to give honor to the father. The son should come to the father and say, I have sinned, forgive me. We have that example. The father in the parable of the prodigal son was wise enough not to go chase his profligate son down when he was sinning and wasting away his life and his inheritance, because at best the runaway son would have been convinced against his will. And so the scriptures say when he came to himself, when he finally woke up, when he finally reached the point of saying, this isn't going to work, that son went back to his father. Maybe David, from the bottom of his heart, was hoping that Absalom would finally, put together all the things that David had taught him all of his life about honor your parents, honor God, honor the king. And Absalom would come back and say, Father, forgive me, I've sinned, or something like that. But it was very complicated. Verse 24. Here's how David dealt with Absalom. The king said, let him turn to his own house and let him not see my face. So Absalom returned to his own house and saw not the king's face. So David is stonewalling Absalom. It's a stalemate. It continues. Nothing is resolved. It is not the best way to solve problems, is just to let them brew and fester. Because for Absalom, all he did was rage and get more angry, more determined in the way that he was going. Could it have been handled better? I think that had Absalom trusted in God the way David trusted in God, there's a very good opportunity, a possibility. God knew how it was going to work out, but perhaps Absalom would have been the one who would have been king, maybe king for a while. Solomon could have been king too. Who knows what would have worked out had Absalom been a godly person. Verse 25. Now, at the same time that David is not having anything to do with Absalom, Absalom's personality, his reputation, his demeanor is being accepted by the nation. He is a public figure. He looks good. He speaks good. He's glib. He's charismatic. He has all these things going for him. Verse 25. But in all Israel, there was none to be so much praised as Absalom for his beauty Now, you know, maybe a lot of young men say, boy, I wish I was good looking. I would get all the babes and all the opportunities and all of those things. Well, that's usually a downfall. It was for Absalom here. It says from the sole of his foot, you know, to the crown of his head, from the bottom of his feet to the tip top of his head, there was no blemish in him. He was just absolutely gorgeous, good looking hunk, just everything going for him. And as we saw last time, he had lots of beautiful hair, you know, and that added to his vanity as well. Drop down to verse 28. So Absalom dwelt 2 full years in Jerusalem. Now this is in addition to the 5 that we've already seen, so we're up to 7 years now. And he saw not the king's face. That's a long time to go without seeing the king. Verse 29. Therefore Absalom sent for Joab to have sent to him the king. To have sent him to the king. You know, Joab, the commander-in-chief, could intervene, act as a mediator, and get Absalom, you know, an audience, a permit, whatever it was in those days, to be able to go in and at least talk to King David. But Joab would not come to him. I don't know if he's too busy, didn't want to get involved, thought that, well, hey, you know, this is not politically expedient, because Joab was very much a political animal himself. And so Absalom sent a second time, and Joab would not come. How do you get somebody's attention when they won't listen? You know, the New Testament tells us to knock and knock and knock, you know, for a chance that just nagging somebody, pestering them so many times, they'll finally give you an answer. Well, that's what Absalom decided to do. Verse 30, therefore Absalom said unto his servants, see, Joab's field is near mine. And he has barley there. Go set it on fire. And Absalom's servants set the field on fire. So he resorted to arson, you know, burning up his barley crop. Well, you know, Joab had plenty of money, and this also shows us that even these men of war, you know, had their own enterprises going on to sustain themselves and their household, because they all had a wife and children and, you know, servants and, you know, in-laws and so forth. Verse 31, then Joab arose and came to Absalom unto his house and said to him, wherefore have your servants set my field on fire? Wasn't any big secret. You know, Absalom, let it be known, I set your field on fire. You know, next it'll be your house or your barn or something probably. Verse 32, Absalom answered Joab, behold, I sent unto you saying, come here, that I may send thee to the king to say, wherefore am I come from Gershon? You know, why did you ask me to come back to Jerusalem in the first place 2 years ago if you weren't going to see me? It would have been good, continuing on in verse 32, for me to have been there still, back in Gershon. Now, therefore, let me see the king's face, and if there be any iniquity in me, let him kill me. Now this is interesting. Look at the end of verse 32. If there be any iniquity in me, let him kill me. Well, he's murdered his brother Amnon. And yet somehow in his own mind there's justification for his actions. And he's serious. You know, if I've done anything wrong, you know, I just did what should have been done a long time ago. But David, you know, pushed again, was finally willing to reconcile with Absalom. Verse 33, so Joab came to the king and told him, and when he had called for Absalom, David called for Absalom, he came into the king, King David, and he bowed himself on his face to the ground before the king. Now that's very proper, showing honor and showing respect for his dad and showing respect to the throne. And the king kissed Absalom. Now, brethren, that's a good place to say, and they lived happily ever after. And that's the end of the story. The king kissed Absalom. We have reconciliation between father and son. But brethren, things are not as good as they might seem. 2 Samuel 15 in verse 1. We touched on these scriptures last time, but let's briefly go over those again. It came to pass after this that Absalom prepared him chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. He becomes, you know, very outward and bold and a political You know, it's just like when we have a president of the United States, and they'll say, you know, he's running for office already, even while he's being the president, because you can be the president, but some of the things that are done are over and beyond the necessary office and duties of the president. You say, hey, he's campaigning. Well, that's what Absalom is doing. He's campaigning here. Verse 2, and Absalom rose up early and stood beside the way of the gate. That's where business was done. That was kind of like the courthouse is today, where you go and you see the judges and you get your permits and all of that sort of thing. And it might be that King David, in his grief and his depression and so forth, maybe he's let down a little bit. Maybe the affairs of state are not being conducted in an expedient way, the way that they should be. And maybe there is a cause for people to say, hey, you know, I can't get an appeal, I can't get my case heard, and so forth. But Absalom, he makes hay while the sun shines, as the saying goes. He finds it expedient to move into this power vacuum, and he starts to make some political hay. And so it was, we're in the middle of verse 2, so it was that when any man that had a controversy came to the king for judgment, then Absalom called unto him and said, of what city art thou? And he said, thy servant is of one of the tribes of Israel. And Absalom said to him, see, your matters are good and right. You know, you've got a case, you've got a point. But there is no man deputized, we might say, of the king to hear you. There's nobody can help you. Sorry. Absalom said moreover, oh, that I were made the judge in the land, that every man which has any suit or cause might come unto me, and I'd do him justice. You know, I would straighten out this bottleneck. I would fix this system. You'd have your petition answered, and everything would, if I were in there. Verse 5, and so it was that when any man came near unto Absalom to do him obeisance, he put forth his hands, and he took him, and he kissed him. And on this manner did Absalom to all Israel that came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. You know, word got around. Boy, I wish Absalom was in there. Things would be running right. You know, can't wait for King David to get old and retire and move off the throne, abdicate, whatever, so Absalom can get in there. Boy, things will really be running right. But brethren, this is where we closed last time. So many people do what is expedient in life, politically expedient in a way that gains them money. They follow after fame. They follow after people that have big reputations and a lot going for them. They hitch their wagon to the star of people who are social climbers or political climbers, rather than taking a stand for godly justice, what is right, the things that are correct in the eyes of God. When studying these scriptures, brethren, we can see from hindsight, because hindsight is perfect, that you don't do these things. You don't just latch on to somebody because things seem to be going their way when you know that they're breaking a rule here and breaking a rule there and that their designs are not godly. You know what? When you want to do something, whether it has to do with your job or your family or who you want to marry or any of those kind of things, your actions can always be justified as reasonable. There was no other choice. I had to do it that way. That was my only option. You know, and people justify things. They'll even justify it to say, you know, God seemed to be working there. That's where God placed his mantle. That's where God's working today. They're the ones that are justified by what they're doing. And so you find, you know, the whole nation of Israel starting to move over behind Absalom because he was good looking and he had everything going for him. He had a winning formula and everything was going to work out. And David, because of his good heart, suspected nothing. You know, there's that principle about the eye of the beholder. We're not going to go there today, but you can read Romans 2. You accuse other people of what you're guilty of. And it has a corollary as well. If you have a good heart, a contrite heart, and a loving heart, you don't see the evil in evil people. David was a man. You know, you can't say he was in a man who in whom there was no guile, as Christ said of a couple of one of the apostles, Nathan, I believe it was, a man who in whom there is no guile. David may have had some guile, but David had a good heart. Create in me a clean heart, O God, was what he prayed. David was thinking that Absalom was developing and growing as a prince should. You know, sure, he's out there with his one-man parade with his fine horses and his chariots and people running in front and back and showing off in front of the girls and all of that kind of stuff. But at the same time, David fully believed that Absalom was maturing, that he would learn, that he would grow, that he'd have a good heart, that he would become, you know, the prince, the heir apparent. But David thought, fully believed that Absalom was working in conjunction with David, not against David, not to overthrow David, but for the plan of God, for the nation of Israel. David never suspected for a moment that Absalom was in opposition to him and that David was going to usurp the throne, let alone, you know, try to commit murder, you know, and to kill David. It never entered David's mind that his son Absalom would turn against him and attempt to destroy him. You know, it was against David's character to overthrow Saul. David had opportunity after opportunity to bump Saul off the throne. God had David anointed. God had given David the word, "You will be the king." And yet David, when he had opportunity to remove Saul, and Saul was trying to kill David, you know, you talk about justify your actions. David, it was not in his character to overthrow Saul. And so David, in his mind's eye, passed these same attributes on in his mind's eye to Absalom, thinking that Absalom was like David, meant well, wanted the best, and would work within God's law and so forth, you know, and let things be worked out. David was not wary nor suspecting that Absalom was out there setting up a coup. Excuse me. David was a man who trusted in God to give him what God had promised. David thought that his son Absalom would be working together with him to achieve the will of God. How could Absalom be so different from David? He's raised in David's own home. He sees David. He hears David. He probably saw as a little boy David praying or fasting or doing some kindly things, I would hope. I wish there were more details so that we could see what Absalom was exposed to. Maybe it was from Absalom's mother that he learned this kind of intrigue. But Absalom was not faithful. He was not true. He was not honest. Absalom was pretending to be religious. He pretended to be godly, but it was for personal gain. 2 Samuel 15 and verse 7. Continuing on. It came to pass after 40 years, I believe that means that Absalom is 40 years old. It's not another 40 years, I don't believe. It came to pass after 40 years that Absalom said unto the king, "I pray thee, let me go and pay my vow, which I have vowed unto the Lord in Hebron." Now, well, you know, David kind of used this same ploy himself a time or two. And you couldn't tell a fellow no, you know, if he promised God that he was going to do a certain thing. And so David honored Absalom's request. Verse 8, Absalom says to David, "For your servant," he's referring to himself as being faithful to David. That's a lie right there, by the way, brethren, because Absalom is not a servant to David. He's an enemy, but David doesn't know it yet. "For your servant vowed a vow while I abode in Geshur in Syria, saying, 'If the Lord shall bring me again indeed to Jerusalem, then I will serve the Lord.'" David sure couldn't say no to that because, you know, God had answered his prayer, and now Absalom is back home. He's a good boy. He's there, you know, doing his daddy's will. He's even praying to God and honoring his vow. And so David, being fond of Absalom, you know, he was comforted with this evidence of godliness in his son. He sent Absalom with his blessing to Hebron. Hey, this boy is doing good. You know, he's fulfilling his vow. Things are really on the up and up. Verse 9. And the king said to him, so David said to Absalom, go in peace. So he arose and he went to Hebron. And what David didn't know is that Absalom was plotting a rebellious overthrow of David's kingdom, which Absalom would surely have inherited if he had only been patient. That's the folly in this whole thing. That's the foolish thing. If the son had just bided his time and waited and learned, he would have grown smarter. He would have grown in wisdom. He would have grown in political alliances, even. He would have had a tremendous foundation. He could have come in and been a good king. Verse 10, but Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, let me just stop there for a second. Isn't it interesting? And we've even seen it in the Church of God. When things are going well, I can remember back in the days of Worldwide, you know, when things were in kind of a steady state condition, many people were responding each week for visit requests from the ministers, and the income was up, and the amount of stations that we were on. You know, it seemed like things were going good. There were still ministers, you know, that were engaged in some kind of intrigue. You know, they said, there's a terrible plot about. Things are amiss. You know, we're going to have to take matters into our own hands. We're going to do this, that, and the other. That's what Absalom was doing. Right here, at a time when there could have been peace and growth in the kingdom, he sends spies throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then you shall say, Absalom reigns in Hebron. So he was fully intent. Absalom was fully intent in being king. Now, Hebron is only about 20 miles from Jerusalem, and it's where, you know, David spent that first 7.5 years, and that's where Absalom was born, by the way. He knew the country and knew the people very well. Absalom had been restored by David, you know, to his former princely, you know, dignified position, and you know, he had the confidence of his father David to go out and to, you know, do these things, to travel about. You know, he had a blank check, as it were to speak. Many times a young man, when he has a wealthy and powerful father, you know, can ride on his father's coattails. And, you know, he has all the money that he wants. He has all the women that he wants. He's talented. He's uninhibited. And so Absalom enters upon a course of secret plotting, you know, because his ambitions are getting the best of him. And he certainly has the opportunity, you know, pushing him forward. And so Absalom is headed towards, you know, really ruining his name. He's headed for revolt. He's going to be rebellious. He doesn't take to heart God's law. Honor your father. Honor the king. And the conspiracy has become fully mature. He's got a man in, you know, every one of the tribes of Israel. To the extent that these men report back to him, I've got so many that'll follow me no matter what. I was once asked the question, you know, how many people will follow you no matter, you know, what happens? Brethren, that is wrong for a minister to have the attitude that people follow him. The people in God's church do not follow the minister. They follow Christ. You know, ministers, even the best of ministers, do the best that they can. Each individual has to follow God. We're answerable to God. You can go back to Romans chapter 14, I believe it is, verses 10 and 12. It says, we're going to individually give an answer to Jesus Christ for our action. And when we get there, we're not going to be able to do like the servants of Absalom. So, well, I was told to do that, so, you know, I'm indemnified. I'm held harmless. We can't do that. So, Absalom, you know, was a hypocrite. And what he did was he gained the confidence of the people, you know, using his princely position. And he was actually getting these people to rebel against the king whom God had chosen. You know, and so Absalom proclaimed himself to be the king. And he entered Jerusalem. Now there was a fellow, his name was Ahithophel, let me spell it, Ahithophel. Ahithophel. I'll tell you who he was. He was Bathsheba's grandfather. Bathsheba's father was one of the mighty men, and this was the father of one of them, the mighty men. But he was one of David's counselors. He was a wise man. He was like a Supreme Court judge would be today. He gave very good advice, but he was a man that lacked some character, as we'll see. So Absalom entered Jerusalem, and on the advice of Ahithophel, he appropriated the wives and the concubines of David as a symbol of having seized the throne, the control of the throne. And as we mentioned last time, you know, when you have all the king's wives and all the king's concubines, that says, okay, you have bumped the king off his throne and you're now in control. 2 Samuel 15 and verse 11. And with Absalom went 200 men out of Jerusalem that were called. I think that means they were drafted. And they went in their simplicity, and they knew not anything. So they were innocent. They were just following orders in a right way. Verse 12, and Absalom sent for Ahithophel, the Gilonite, David's counselor. So you notice Ahithophel is David's counselor from his city, even from Gilo, while he offered sacrifices, and the conspiracy was strong, for the people increased continually with Absalom. So more and more, it's just like we see in a political race, as the 4 years of a president's term come to an end, actually in that beginning of that fourth year, when you have all the elections and everything, you can see somebody's power and esteem rising, and other, you know, you see the candidates waxing and Wayne. Well, in this particular case, Absalom was growing strong, and so was his conspiracy to take over the throne. Verse 13. There came a messenger to David saying, the hearts of the men of Israel are after Absalom. Well, David could say, hey, been there, done that. Remember when David was young and had killed Goliath, and he went dancing through the streets and everything, and all the girls saying, you know, Saul killed 100 and David killed 1,000. Well, you know, this wouldn't be shocking for David to see that Absalom is growing in popularity. Verse 13 shows that David found out about it. Verse 14, and David said unto all of his servants that were with him at Jerusalem, arise and let us flee, for we shall not else escape from Absalom. So David perceived that, unlike his case where he was going to be loyal to Saul, David finally wakes up and realizes that Absalom is out to do him in, to take him off the throne and kill him. I don't know how David came to that realization. It must have been a horrible realization. It's like when you overhear a private conversation and you become privy to something that somebody didn't want you to know, and all of a sudden the stark truth is right there and you have to face it. And so David realizes that the jig is up and they have to flee for their lives, or we shall not escape from Absalom. Continuing on in verse 14, make speed to depart, lest he overtake us suddenly and bring evil upon us and smite the city with the edge of the sword. So David must have had a good inkling of what Absalom was capable of. Even in his fondest wishes of hoping that Absalom would turn out good, all of a sudden, somehow, it is totally obvious that Absalom is moving in and taking over, and he's going to take over the throne. David realized that Absalom became so heartless that he was willing to make war even against his own father. And yet, even in spite of all of that, the love of David persisted towards Absalom. It stayed there. Drop down to verse 24. 2 Samuel 15 and verse 24. And lo, Zadok also and all the Levites were with him. Now we're talking about the priestly duties, the ones that ran the holy things. I started to say the temple, but the temple is going to be built by Solomon later. And there was a tent that they had brought the ark up into and so forth. It was not the original tabernacle that was set up. And so Zadok also and all the Levites were with him, bearing the ark of the covenant. And they set down the ark of God, and Abiathar went up until all the people had done passing out of the city. Well, what these men had decided to do, Zadok, the head religious leader of that time, they said, David, we're coming with you, and we're bringing the ark of the covenant. You know, we're taking the church with us, and we're taking, you know, God with us, and we got him in a box. And they weren't being quite that facetious. But, brethren, you cannot just carry the ark around with you for protection, you know, like people do with St. Christopher's medals. You know, I've got a St. Christopher medal, nothing can happen to me. I've got the ark of the covenant with me, and nothing can happen. And this is a concept that persisted throughout Israel's history. And God says, hey, don't you believe it, you know, later on. Places where God had placed his name were utterly ruined. God's not interested in material things. He's interested in people growing in spiritual wisdom. That's the only thing that is going to continue to exist. Temples will fall. Buildings will fall. Organizations will fall. The only thing that remains is the Spirit of God. Go back to the New Testament church. You know, it's not the buildings or the relics or any of those things that are important. It's the character that was built by God's Holy Spirit in the apostles, in the disciples, and in the first converts, in the brethren, the saints of the church. And it's the same today. So you can't just carry the ark around with you. So David says, no. We're not going to bring the ark with us. We don't have a command from God to move it. You don't just go moving the ark of God unless you have some special instructions from God. So David said, leave it in Jerusalem. If it's God's will, I'll be back. And we see that approach so many times with the men of God in the Bible. We saw it with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. If it's God's will, it will be done. And if not, you know, then that's God's will too. So David says, I'll be back, you know, if it's God's will. Of course it was. 2 Samuel 15, verse 25, continuing. And the king said unto Zadok, carry back the ark of God into the city. If I shall find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he'll bring me again and show me both it and its habitation. I'll be back, and I'll see, you know, where the ark of the covenant is. Now, brethren, put your marker here as we come to 2 Samuel 16. We'll come back here in just a little bit. But I want to review something here that's important. 2 Samuel 12. Let's go back a few chapters to 2 Samuel 12. And this is where David is caught red-handed for the adultery with Bathsheba. And Nathan has come to him and told him the story about the rich man who took the one little lamb. And David pronounced the death sentence on that man that had taken the one lamb because he had plenty of his own. In verse 7, 2 Samuel 12 and verse 7, and Nathan said to David, you are the man. Thus says the Lord God of Israel, I anointed you king over Israel, and I delivered you out of the hand of Saul. I gave you your master's house, and I gave you your master's wives into your bosom. See, there again, we see that concept of inheriting the wives. But with the wives, you inherit the children. And with the wives and the children, you inherit their estates and their lands. And that's the way property was maintained and ownership and so forth. David inherited all of that. And God says, and if that had been too little, you know, if that didn't satisfy you and that wasn't enough, I would have, moreover, have given you such and such things. In other words, you name it, I would have given it to you. Verse 9. Wherefore have you despised? In other words, how did you despise the commandment of the Lord to do evil in his sight? David, how with, you know, these children, Amnon and Absalom and Chileab and all these wives and all of this stuff, how did you despise the commandment of God? Break one of the Ten Commandments to do evil in His sight. You killed Uriah the Hittite with the sword. You've taken his wife to be your wife. And you've slain him with the sword of the children of Ammon. So God holds David guilty for what he had done, this terrible sin. Verse 10. Notice what God said. And this is what we are seeing today, brethren, this curse that God puts on David. Verse 10. Now this is interesting. God forgives David, but he also has to bear this penalty, this punishment. Now therefore, God says to David, the sword shall never depart from your house. Now that doesn't mean the house like we have four walls and a roof. It's talking about these sons of David. Amnon, Absalom, Chileab, Solomon, and a whole bunch of them, a whole slew of them. Solomon was number 10. We'll see that again. From your household, the sword, the battle, the killings, always going to be in your household. Continuing in the middle of verse 10, because you have despised me and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. Because David broke a covenant. Uriah had a covenant with his wife. It was a law. It became the law of God. And David violated that. As he just said, you despise the commandment of God. Verse 11. Thus says the Lord, behold, I will raise up evil against you out of your own house or household, and I will take your wives before your eyes, and I will give them unto your neighbor. Now at this time, we know that David has at least six wives, and he's working on Bathsheba, number seven, that he had down. The six he had down in Hebron we saw last time. And he, the one who's taking your wife, shall lie with your wives in the sight of the sun. In other words, everybody in the whole nation is going to know that another man is sleeping with your wives. Verse 12. For you did it secretly. See, David did it by intrigue. This was a low point in David's life when he took Bathsheba. You know, when she's taking that bath on top of a nearby house, and he plotted to kill Uriah, like, hey, you know, one more useless guy that I'll get rid of. And Uriah was one of his valiant men, just like Bathsheba's daddy was. They knew each other. You did it secretly, verse 12, but I will do this thing before all Israel and before the sun. And David said unto Nathan, and here we see David's repentant attitude. I have sinned against the Lord. It's an admission of guilt. You know, the sorrow, the forgiveness, the mercy, all of these things come into play in verse 13. And God realized that David was truly repentant. You know, and there are whole chapters about David's repentance. And Nathan said unto David, the Lord also has put away your sin. You shall not die. Why should he die? Because he placed his own death penalty on himself. The man that has done this, he will surely die. David put the death penalty on himself, the death sentence on himself, and it would have had to have been carried out. But Nathan waives it. You shall not die. Now let's go back to 2 Samuel, this time chapter 16, where your marker is, brethren. Let's begin in verse 15. And Absalom and all the people, the men of Israel, came to Jerusalem, and Ahithophel with them. And there in Jerusalem, Absalom proclaimed himself to be king. I'm not really sure whether he said, I will be king when he was in Hebron, but somewhere along in here, it becomes obvious that Absalom has proclaimed himself to be king. Verse 20. Drop down a little bit. And Absalom said to Ahithophel, now remember, this is the grandpa of Bathsheba. And brethren, there's a very good chance that Ahithophel is carrying a grudge. He's carrying a grudge because of this whole affair, the sordid affair between David and Bathsheba. That brought shame to Ahithophel's family name. That was his granddaughter. King David violated his granddaughter. And Ahithophel might not have ever really turned loose of that, or come to terms with it, even when David repented and took Bathsheba for his wife, because once Uriah was dead, now in some states in the Union, you can't profit from a felony. If you rob a bank, you can't say I'm sorry and keep the money, and you wouldn't be able to kill somebody's wife, you know, to have the wife, and then the judge say, okay, I find you had reasonable, well, you got off killing the husband, you don't get to keep the wife. But David did. David was able to marry Bathsheba because Uriah was dead, and it's a whole clean slate. And that's hard for us to grasp the justice in that. But David took Bathsheba to wife, and it must have continued to eat on Ahithophel, her grandfather. Then said Absalom, we're in verse 20, to Ahithophel, give counsel among you what we shall do. So what happened is, on the advice of Ahithophel, Absalom goes and takes all the wives of David. We'd call it a harem today, the royal harem. And Ahithophel told Absalom, you take David's wives as a symbol of taking control of his throne, the royal control of Israel, verse 21. And Ahithophel said it to Absalom, go in unto your father's concubines. These are David's concubines, which he has left to keep the house. I think David left 10 of them back. We'll skip over that right now. And all Israel shall hear that you are abhorred of your father, because, see, this is an unforgivable act. And the Bible is very, very clear that you can't do this. It's breaking God's standards and man's standards and his father's standards and everything. Then shall the hands of all that are with you be strong. We're having a clear demarcation here between the rule of David and the rule of Absalom. And so Absalom is taking over, and there are people that cheer men on, even in their adultery, even in this incest. This is a type of incest, and spiritual incest, and royal incest, to take your father's wives this way, even though they're the concubines. Verse 22, they make a big shindig out of this. So they spread Absalom a tent upon the top of the house, and Absalom went into his father's concubines in the sight of all Israel. Well, God had told David that that was going to happen. This is because of David's sin. God is allowing this to happen. Verse 23, and the counsel of Ahithophel, which he counseled in those days, was if a man had inquired at the oracle of God, so was all the counsel of Ahithophel, both with David and with Absalom. His counsel was highly respected. Verse 7, let's go to 2 Samuel 17 now, in verse 1. Moreover, Ahithophel said unto Absalom, let me now choose out 12,000 men, and I will arise and pursue after David this night. Now, let's get an oversight of what happens. Absalom has come to Jerusalem from Hebron, 20 miles away. He's taking over, you know, by the edge of the sword, as the scripture says. David has left town. He's running for his life with, you know, a number of the priests and counselors and wives and goods and so forth. And Ahithophel says, okay, here's what you do next. Now, Absalom's going to get counsel from a couple of people. What do we do now? You know, do I park it here in Jerusalem and just start serving, or do I go kill David because, you know, David might come back, or what do I do? And so Ahithophel's advice, and it's actually the best advice, and I'll just tell you right up front, his advice is not going to be followed, because God spoils the counsel of Ahithophel, but it's the one that would have worked. Let me now choose out 12,000 men, and I will arise and pursue after David this night. So we see that Ahithophel is carrying this grudge against David for the affair that he had with Bathsheba. And Ahithophel, who had been David's counselor, is saying, now, I'll go kill him tonight. With 12,000 men, I won't have any problem. David had, you know, 600 or 800. The Bible says he's got 600 of a certain type of men, and he's got others. Verse 2. I will come upon him while he's weary and weak. He's been running for his life. He's older. He's weak-handed, and I'll make him afraid, and all the people that are with him shall flee, and I will smite the king only. So, you know, we'll really get a very good deal out of this, because only David will be dead, and all the other people will be coming back. There's a high efficiency here. We won't lose anybody, so to speak. Verse 3. And I will bring back all the people unto you. The man whom thou seekest is as if all return. So all the people shall be in peace. So, you know, I'll get rid of David. Just you know, cut him out of the bunch, and then everything will all live happily ever after, is what he's saying right there. Verse 4. And the saying pleased Absalom well, and all the elders of Israel. Hey, that's a plan. That'll work. You know, run him down with 12,000 men tonight while he's tired, and everybody will flee from him, and you know, by tomorrow everything will be at peace. Then Absalom said, call now Hushai. Now, Hushai, the Archite, is actually a spy for David. And he's in there. He's made himself close to Absalom. And he's going to turn over the council of Ahithophel. And let us hear likewise what he says. Well, Hushai is a pretty good speaker and very convincing. And so when Hushai was come in verse 6 to Absalom, Absalom spoke unto him, saying, Ahithophel has spoken such and such after this manner. Shall we do after his saying? If not, you speak. You know, what's the alternative? And Hushai says to Absalom, the counsel of Ahithophel has given you is not good at all at this time. Good counsel, but not at this time. It's not going to work. For, said Hushai. And Hushai is going to paint a really good picture of David's history. You remember all of David's comeback when he was in the hills? You know, he was kind of like a freedom fighter, popping in, popping out. He was one of these guerrilla fighters. And Hushai is going to hearken back to that. He says, you know your father and his men, that they be mighty men. They're powerful, like the Green Berets or like the Special Ops today, really sharp and well-trained. And boy, they're chaffed in their minds. You know, they're really ticked right now, just like a bear when she's robbed of her little baby whelps, her cubs in the field. And your father's a man of war, and he will not lodge with the people. He's not with those 600 or 700 people. He's laying in wait. No matter what you do, he's gonna really put the hurt on you. Verse 9. Behold, even now he's hidden in some cave or some pit or some other place. And it will come to pass, when some of them be overthrown at the first, that whosoever hears it will say, there's a slaughter among the people that follow Absalom. That's what would happen. You know, David would pop out of the brush, you know, kill a dozen or a couple of dozen, and everybody would panic and run for their lives. And Hushai tells Absalom, that's what's going to happen tonight if you go chasing him with 12,000. He'll knock off a couple of hundred. All the rest of them are flee, and the jig will be up, and Absalom, you'll be out of here, and David will be back in power, because people like to follow power. They like to follow the one that's got a winning roll, and David will win. Verse 10, and he also that is valiant, whose heart is as the heart of a lion, shall utterly melt. I don't care how good your guys are, Absalom. When David jumps out and kills a few of them, they're going to all just faint. For all Israel knows that your father is a mighty man, and they that which be with him are valiant men. Verse 11. Therefore, Hushai says to Absalom, I counsel that all Israel be generally gathered unto you from Dan to Beersheba. That's 150 miles. As the sand that's by the sea for multitude, that you go into battle in your own person. So Hushai says, here's the way to do it. What you do is you get tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of men from all over Israel, and you be their leader, and you go in there and conquer David. Verse 12. So shall we come upon him in some place where he shall be found, and will light upon him as the dew falls on the ground. There's not a spot that's not wet. And of him, all the men that are with you there shall not be left so much as one. We'll wipe out the whole bunch of them. We'll just totally overwhelm them. Moreover, if he holds up in some city, if David moves into some city and it's got some walls, no problem. Then shall all Israel bring ropes to that city and will draw it into the river until there not be one stone found there. You know, David can't, you know, he can run, but he can't hide. You know, so Hushai is really telling Absalom this great story, And Absalom's taken it all in. And Absalom, verse 14, and all the men of Israel said, the counsel of Hushai the Archite is better than the counsel of Ahithophel. Now, the truth is, brethren, is that if they had done what Ahithophel said, you know, David would have been killed that night. But God turned the counsel of Ahithophel, you know, around, and Hushai was accepted. Notice in the middle of verse 14, for the Lord had appointed to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel. It was good counsel. God says so. It was good that it would have worked. Wouldn't have been good for David. To the intent that the Lord might bring evil upon Absalom. Verse 15. Then said Hushai to Zadok and to Abithar the priest, thus and thus did Ahithophel counsel Absalom and the elders of Israel, and thus of our counsel. So word gets back to David, verse 16. Now therefore, send quickly and tell David, saying, lodge not this light in the plains of the wilderness, but speedily pass over, lest the king be swallowed up and all the people that are with him. Drop down to verse 23. Now, in verse 23, Ahithophel saw that his counsel was not followed. And when he saw that he was out, he knew exactly what was going to happen. He was a man of wisdom, even though he was not a godly man. And so Ahithophel, he went home and he hung himself. And that was the end of Bathsheba's grandfather. 2 Samuel 18 and verse 5. We're back to King David. He commanded Joab and Abishai and Ittai, saying, deal gently for my sake with the young man, even with Absalom. And all the people heard when the king gave all the captains charge concerning Absalom. So Absalom is following Hushai's advice, and he's coming in a big war against King David in a big battle. And David, he's not worried about the battle. He just says, you know, don't hurt Absalom. Don't kill Absalom. Deal gently for my sake with the young man. David is saying to all the army, to his valiant men, don't kill Absalom. And all the people heard when the king gave all the captains charge concerning Absalom. Joab heard it. All the men heard it. Verse 6. So the people went out into the field against Israel, and the battle was in the wood of Ephraim. Now, you know, you choose your place to fight. And David chose well. Verse 7. And when the people of Israel was slain before the servants of David, and there was a great slaughter that day of 20,000 men. Well, the most they could have lost the night before was 12,000, because that's all they had. But now they lose 20,000 because the war is going for David and against Absalom. Verse 8. For the battle was there scattered over the face of all the country, and the wood devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. People, you know, getting a branch run through a lung, falling off of cliffs, drowning, you know, the tide was being turned. Verse 9, and Absalom met the servants of David, and Absalom rode a mule, and the mule went under the thick boughs of a great oak, and his head caught hold of the oak. Remember, all that hair is working against him now. And he was taken up between the heaven and the earth, means that, you know, he was hanging by his hair and his feet didn't touch the ground. And the mule that was under him went away. The mule ran out from under him. And a certain man saw it, and he told Joab, and he said, behold, I saw Absalom, you know, hanging in an oak tree. You know, he just couldn't get himself out of the branches. He couldn't do a pull up and get over the branch and get loose. He was that tangled up. And Joab said unto the man that told him, and behold, we're in verse 11, thou sawest him, and why did you not smite him there to the ground? I would have given you 10 shekels of silver and a girdle. You know, I'd have made you a rich man if you had killed him right then and there. And the man said unto Joab, though I should receive 1,000 shekels of silver in my hand, yet would I not put forth my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing the king charged you and Abishai and Ittai, saying, beware that none touch the young man Absalom. This man was bold enough to tell Joab to his face, you're violating what King David gave you orders. You're not following orders. Verse 13. Otherwise, I should have wrought falsehood against my own wife. You know, that man knew, and there's plenty of examples in the Bible, had he violated what David said, he would have been killed. The people that took credit for killing Saul in Ishbosheth, you know, David put them all to death. And this man knew he would have lost his own life. For there's no matter hid from the king, and you yourself would have set yourself against me. He's saying, Joab, you would have been the first one to kill me if I would have done something like that. You know, you're just talking nonsense to say you would have given me a big reward. Then said Joab, I may not tarry thus with you. I'm wasting my time talking to you is what he said. And he took three darts in his hand, sometimes it says javelins, and he thrust them through the heart of Absalom while he was yet alive in the midst of the oak. Now, it doesn't say in the scriptures that Joab killed him, but I don't see how you could put three long darts through his heart and he was still alive. But it says in the next verse, and 10 young men that bore Joab's armor compassed about and smote Absalom and slew him. They wanted to get in on the action, and they did it so quickly that Joab was still somewhat alive, still breathing a little bit or gasping. And these men, you know, finished him off. Verse 16. And Joab blew the trumpet, you know, signaling the war was over. And the people returned from pursuing after Israel, for Joab held back the people. You know, nobody wants to just keep killing uselessly. It's time to put the country back together, just like after a presidential election. If the men have any honor at all, they bury the hatchet the next day and say, hey, now we've got to work together. It was a good fight. And that's what Joab's doing. Verse 17. And they took Absalom and they cast him into a great pit in the wood, or, you know, out there where the battle was going on. And they laid a very great heap of stones upon him, and all Israel fled, everyone to his tent. Now, to my understanding, I think that's where Absalom still is, even though Absalom built a monument to himself. I've seen this in 2 Samuel 18:18. Even though there's only a large pile of rocks that mark his grave. Notice that Absalom, in the height of his pride, he's even put a monument up to himself. It'd be like if Washington had built the Washington Monument to honor himself. Now, Absalom, in his lifetime, verse 18, had taken and reared up for himself a pillar, you know, a big monument, which is in the King's Dale. Now, Josephus tells us that this is just a quarter mile outside of Jerusalem. That's the one I saw, so I'm assuming that it's the same one. Who knows? For he said, I have no son to keep my name. Absalom had three sons, but they died before he did, to keep my name in remembrance. And he called the pillar after his own name, and it is called unto this day Absalom's place. So while this is going on, messengers brought word to David that Absalom had been killed. Let's pick it up in verse 31. 2 Samuel 18 and verse 31. And behold, Cushi came, and Cushi said, tidings, my lord. He's not the first messenger to come to David. Nobody wanted to bring David the bad news that Absalom was dead, because they had seen David grieve before. Nobody wanted to say it, and so David really has to pull it out of them. Tidings, my lord the king, for the Lord hath avenged thee this day of all them that rose up against you. Cushi's trying to soften the blow, and he even chooses his words very carefully, as we see in verse 32. He doesn't want to come right out and say, you know, Joab killed Absalom. And the king said to Cushi, is the young man Absalom safe? You know, direct, straightforward question. And Cushi answered, the enemies of my lord the king and all that rise up against thee to do thee hurt, be as that young man is. In other words, you know, death to all those rebels, as that young man is dead. And so David knew that Absalom was dead. Verse 33, and the king was much moved. He's grieving horribly. And he went up to the chamber over the gate, and he wept. And as he went, thus he said, oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would God I had died for thee, O Absalom, my son, my son. In all of his betrayal, you see the pure love of the father for the son. This is the love that God the Father had for Jesus Christ. This is the love that Jesus Christ has for us. This is the love that David had for his son Absalom. You know, God loved us while we were yet sinners, brethren. And David loved his son Absalom. He wanted the best for him. He would have died in Absalom's place just so that Absalom would have had the chance, the opportunity. Let's go to 19, 2 Samuel 19 and verse 1. And it was told Joab, "Behold, the king weeps and mourns for Absalom." Well, now that just really rubbed Joab the wrong way. Now, Joab does not have any natural affection. He is a brutish man. Verse 2. "And the victory that day was turned into mourning unto all the people. For the people heard say that day how the king was grieved for his son." See, it should have been a day of victory for all of Israel and for Judah and for David. But David was so heavy with mourning. Verse 3. "And the people got them by stealth that day into the city," back into Jerusalem, "as people being ashamed steal away when they flee in battle." Well, when somebody is in battle and he's a turncoat and he runs away, he's a traitor, you don't want anybody to see you. Well, the people were the same way, because David was mourning, and the people fled back into the city. Verse 4, "But the king covered his face, and the king cried with a loud voice, 'Oh, my son Absalom, oh, Absalom, my son, my son.'" He just goes on and on like this, and all the people know it. And this really makes Joab mad and angry. Verse 5, "And Joab came into the house of the king," and he just really reads David the riot act. He says, "You have shamed this day the faces of all your servants, which this day have saved your life." They all went out there and they fought for you. And you're just making a travesty of what they did. Continuing on in verse 5, "And the lives of your sons and your daughters and the lives of your wives and the lives of your concubines." You were all of these were saved, David, by what we did. Verse 6, "In that you love your enemies and hate your friends, for you have declared this day that you regard neither princes nor servants." And see, there again we see that David is not a respecter of persons. He loves his sons. He's not really holding the princes or the servants in the highest regard. "For this day I perceive that if Absalom had lived and we'd all died, then it would have pleased you well." You'd have just been tickled pink. If we'd all got killed and Absalom was still alive. Well, that's not what David was saying. He's lost his son. And Absalom is guilty, and he's actually guilty of, killing, of murder, of killing him. It was in war, but it was against orders. Verse 7. Joab gives David some advice here that is important advice, and David realizes the importance of it, and he does it. Because if David had just stayed inside, sighing and mourning and crying and weeping for Absalom, then the people would have been confused and they would have scattered, and it was a time to pull all the people back together. So Joab says, "Look, David, you got to go down there and stand out there and tell the people good job and thanks. You got to welcome the troops back home, so to speak." Verse 7. "Now therefore," Joab says to David, "arise, go forth and speak comfortably to your servants. For I swear by the Lord, if you go not forth, there will not tarry one with you this night." You're going to lose all the people that support you, David. "And that will be worse unto thee than all the evil that has befallen you from your youth until now." You're going to lose the whole kingdom. You're going to blow it right now, the way you're sobbing and crying over Absalom. It's confusing the people. They don't understand these higher things that you have going on in your mind. You love your son, and that's a sad thing. They're thinking about the nation. They're thinking about the future of the whole nation. Verse 8. "So then David arose. The king arose, and he sat in the gate. And they told unto all the people, saying, 'Behold, the king doth sit in the gate.' And all the people came before the king. For Israel had fled, every man to his tent. Brethren, in closing, let's go look at some of the instructions that David gives to his son Solomon. Solomon is his number 10 son. Solomon is the second son of Bathsheba. God personally chose Solomon to be David's heir, to begin ruling. Even while David was still alive, Solomon ascended to the throne. God is the one that chose Solomon as king. There were still a few men that wanted to be king that were older sons of David, but Solomon is the one that is chosen. 1 Kings chapter 2, 1 Kings chapter 2, verse 1. Now the days of David drew near that he should die. He's getting old and sick. And he charged Solomon his son, saying, verse 2, I go the way of all the earth. Be you strong, therefore, and show yourself a man. And David's going to die. He wants Solomon to be strong and courageous. Step up to the plate, we would say. You know, be a good king. Verse 3. Here's the instructions that David gives to Solomon. This is the only thing that works. The political intrigue that Absalom went through, the wars, the battles, trusting in the sword, trusting in the numbers and all those things, none of that avails anything. This is the only thing that will work. This is the way to rule the nation of Israel. And David has combined, unified the kingdom. It's a united kingdom of Israel. All the nations, all the tribes are together. The 12 tribes of Israel. Verse 3. And keep the charge of the Lord your God, the eternal thy God, to walk in his ways, to keep his statutes and his commandments. You know, David had broken his share. You know, and certainly Absalom had broken them all. Brethren, there is a point of identity that the Bible gives us. When you break one of the commandments, you break all of the commandments. So David, when he committed adultery, didn't just commit adultery. He put God last. You know, from that one all the way to coveting number 10. You know, he coveted another man's wife. He broke all the commandments in between. Continuing on in verse 3. Walk in his statutes, his commandments, and his judgments, and his testimonies, as it is written in the law of Moses, that you may prosper in all that you do, and whithersoever thou turnest thyself. Well, we know that Solomon began to keep that instruction as the wisest man that there ever was. Verse 4, David continuing in his instruction to Solomon. And that the Lord, this is the eternal, may continue in his word which he spoke concerning me, saying, if your children take heed to their way, to walk before me in truth, walk before God in truth, with all of their heart and with all of their soul, there shall not fail you, said he, a man on the throne of Israel. So God had promised David that if they would walk in God's commands with all of their heart, you know, there would always be a man, a son of David, on the throne of Israel. Verse 5. Moreover, now this is some instructions in verse 5 that David is going to give to Solomon to take care of some business, to mop up some unfinished business, to clean up some things that David never got to take care of. Moreover, you know also what Joab, the son of Zeruiah, did to me. Well, now, I would have thought that the first thing that he would say right here is, Joab killed Absalom, you go and kill him. But notice that David doesn't do that. He talks about a number of other issues, but he doesn't mention that one yet. Moreover, you know what Joab, the son of Zeruiah, did to me, and what he did to the two captains of the host of Israel, and to Abner and to Ner. Now, brethren, we don't have time, and we're not going to go there, but you can put this in your notes. Verses 31 and 33, you'll see that Abner and Ner were innocent men, as were some others. They didn't deserve to be killed. It was wrong for Joab to kill them. So David is reminding Solomon what he did to the two captains of the host of Israel, and to Abner and to Ner, and also unto Amasa and to Jethro, who he slew, and shed the blood of war in peace. You know, those were acts of war, but it was peacetime. And he put the blood of war upon his girdle, it was about his loins, and in the shoes that were on his feet. In other words, Joab shed innocent blood. And for that, he should die. But you notice, David doesn't mention Absalom here. Verse 6. Do therefore according to your wisdom, and we know Solomon had all the wisdom that there was, and let not his hoary head or his gray hair go down to the grave in peace. In other words, you know, you need to execute Joab. Don't let him die, you know, with his boots on. Don't let him die a peaceful death. Verse 7. But show kindness unto the sons of Barzillai and Gileadite, and let them be of those that eat at your table. For so they came to me when I fled because of Absalom your brother. In other words, pay these guys back. They stood by me in a time of crisis. So see, brethren, Joab killed Absalom too, but Absalom was guilty. And so David doesn't say to Solomon, kill Joab for killing Absalom. Absalom was deserving of the death penalty. You kill Joab, he says to Solomon, for these things for which he's guilty of breaking the law. And so they brought David back to Jerusalem, and David became king over all Israel, and there was some difficulty in that. You can study through that, because David, at this point in his life, he's letting God do everything for him. He's not a political animal. He's not really trying to pull everything together himself and making it work. Again, the fruit of David's perennial indulgence, his unwillingness, you know, to correct his sons, was made evident. At this particular time, there was one who aspired to the throne. It was Solomon's brother, Adonijah. He was a very goodly man, it says in the Bible, in his person and so forth. But he was also unprincipled, and he was reckless. Adonijah had very little restraint in his life. The Bible says his father had not displeased him at any time in saying, "Why have you done so?" David didn't correct Adonijah, it seemed. And so Adonijah rose up, you know, to try to be the king. That's another story. But Joab, through many of his own guilty crimes, even though he had been loyal to the throne, when he joined in a conspiracy against Solomon, you know, Solomon took him out. You know, brethren, Absalom, in closing, Absalom could have been the king. I think that he probably would have been had he trusted in God. But Absalom tried to force things his way. He did not honor his father. That's a major sin. He did not honor the king. He didn't have patience. He didn't have trust. Absalom did not wait on God. Absalom lost everything. Brethren, I think it's a good example for us as we go through the scriptures to tell ourselves over and over, choose God's way. Even when it seems like the bad guys are winning, even when it seems like others are getting ahead, do what is right. Do what is trust. Do like David did. Trust in the Lord.